You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
My full name is Thane R. Curtis, and yes, it is initial only. I was born on August 17, 1951, in Idle Falls, Idaho. That's in Bonneville County.
Thane Curtis is a strong and generous man who has done and continues to do a great deal of good in this world, quietly and without any need for recognition. He was raised in Idaho by good parents working on the family farm with his siblings. He eventually was called on a mission to Pennsylvania, where he met his sweetheart Kathy, as she was also serving. Together they had three wonderful kids, Lance, Jason, and Katie. He later joined the military and became a dog handler, a position he loved and one that proved to be a great blessing in his life. Because of it, his family had the opportunity to live in several places, including New Mexico, Idaho, and Alabama. Upon retiring, Thane and Kathy settled in Boise, where he began a job as a software architect, and he's been with his company for 32 years. Far too early in her life, Kathy was diagnosed with dementia, and Thane became her loyal, diligent caregiver through that time. He did not shirk his responsibilities and took it as an opportunity to show his dear wife an incredible amount of love before she passed away. Nowadays, Thane is still working, building furniture, driving his Tesla, and best of all, being grandpa to his awesome grandkids. His life has taken many twists and turns, but throughout he's remained faithful to the Lord and submitted to God's will. To start, Thane has an important message to share with his family about what it means to be a Curtis.
Curtises have always been in the background and not in the forefront. I want people to know that we Curtises do not sit on the front row. We don't want accolades. We don't want to be on the front row. But we want to get the work done, and so we do. We're also not quitters. That's important to know. Curtises are not quitters, no matter how hard it is.
Thane grew up with loving parents, a rich family history, and lots of delicious food.
My father's full name is Ramon Richie Curtis. And my mother's name is Wilma Grace Bird. He was in the Army for a little bit and was going to be a radio man. He was chopping wood for his grandma, and a splinter got in his left eye, and eventually he lost his eye. He entered World War II, and they were on their way to go to Germany to become occupation troops. While they were in New Jersey awaiting to board the waiting for orders, his commander told him to go to New York and get a new glass eye, and so he did. While he was gone, the unit shipped out to Europe without him. So he came back, and instead of being a radio man, he was a clerk typist, and he was mustering people out of the Army. And eventually, his name showed up on the list, and he mustered himself out of the Army. Came back to Idaho, where he met my mother. He was trained as an electrician, worked for KID Radio. He used to climb the radio towers at the very top and change the light bulbs. Eventually, he started his own business, Curtis Electric. So they just celebrated the 50-year anniversary of the company. It was awesome what he started. My mother worked out of the home a little here and there. I know my folks dabbled a little bit. They had a laundromat for a while, because I can remember going to the laundromat and working on machines and how our hands got filthy dirty from the coins. I remember that distinctly. They did that for a little bit. Eventually, they decided that on the side, they would move to a farm. And that's where I grew up, on a farm on what I call Iona Road. I know that is that. But I remember growing up on the farm and raising farm animals and learning how to drive tractors and milking cows by hand. And I still remember the day my dad brought home a milking machine and how I thought that was the best thing he ever did. So, because I was so tired of milking the cows by hand and fighting with them all the time. So anyway, my dad was a quiet, strong person. My mother was a real gregarious person and wanted to meet everybody. She knew everybody. She knew everybody's name. She met somebody once. She always remembered their name. She was really awesome at that. My mother, because she helped her mother all the time in the house, was a great homemaker and knew how to cook awesomely. My grandma Bird would make 21 loaves of bread every other day. Grandma Bird had a recipe where she would take mashed potatoes and very thick chicken noodle soup and put it on the mashed potatoes. And that is the best comfort food you can have. It is so awesome.
Thane's childhood was full of working on the farm with his siblings and playing with his cousins.
I have an older brother, Verl, who goes by the name of Kurt, K-U-R-T. I have an older sister, Maureen. And then I have I know that I will get to know my two little twin baby sisters that were stillborn after me, about a year after I was born. And it'll be a precious time. And then I have a younger brother, Stanton, after them. After Stanton is Colleen. After Colleen is Scott. Then we have our angel little sister, Ramona. The Curtises didn't have a lot of family gatherings. However, on my mother's side, my Grandpa Bird's house was the party house, I think, for everybody. There were some trips I remember going up to Island Park area, going to Palisades area. I can remember a trip to Glacier National Park. For us boys, all the boys had a tent, the girls had a tent, and staying up till hours of the morning, giggling, laughing, and my uncles, you kids be quiet, we're trying to sleep, you know, and all that kind of business going on. So we had a lot of good cousins. That's what I remember for fun. But I mean, there were some after school activities that we were able to do, but not a lot, because I just remember there was farm work that had to get done. And if we didn't do it, it didn't get done.
Thane has many fond memories of his young school days from elementary all the way until he attended BYU-Idaho as a young adult.
I remember going to elementary school, UConn Elementary School. I went to seventh grade in a building next to the UConn Elementary School, which was the old high school that my mother graduated from, high school, that building. People like me that were farm kids, they would take us to Ammon Junior High School for eighth grade. And the Ammon kids didn't want us there, and we didn't want to be there. It was not a fun year. And we were so excited as farm kids that we got to go to high school in ninth grade and went to Monteville High School. We used to build bonfires for homecoming. And we would build bonfires out of any kind of wood we could scavenge anywhere, including outhouses. We got so bad stealing outhouses, they wouldn't let us bring an outhouse to the bonfire unless we had a note from the person that we could take their outhouse. I mean, outhouses were very prevalent still. And we were doing our best to clean up the environment, even though we didn't know it. I was on the yearbook committee. I was a photographer, I think, for only 1 year. Played trumpet in high school. And I wasn't very good. And then I graduated and thought I was free. And I went to Ricks College, and when I went for a year, Maureen was there. We didn't have a lot of money. I remember going across campus one day, and I had a whole dime in my pocket because I was rich. And Maureen asked me if I had any money so she could go buy an ice cream cone. And I gave her my dime. Now, there must be something wrong with me to give my sister a dime to go buy an ice cream cone. But anyway, we drove an old Rambler car, I think, or an old Chevy car. I lived in a little apartment with some other folks and survived on cereal. After that year at Ricks College, I was hired to work at the Diamond Little Theater in Jackson Hole, Wyoming for the summer. I also worked part-time at a steakhouse in Jackson. And that was great because I got one meal while I was working and one meal after I was working. And I could have anything on the menu I wanted except for steak. And if I wanted steak, I had to pay a dollar, which is not a whole lot of money, even in those days.
Thane is a faithful member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. His family joined the church generations ago, a heritage Thane is both grateful for and proud of.
My great-great-grandfather, Lyman Curtis, joined the church with his family. My great-great-grandfather, Lyman, met his wife, Charlotte, in Zion's Camp. Lyman went with Brigham Young on the first group of saints to come west of the Salt Lake Valley in 47. Then he went back and got Charlotte and the kiddos, and then they came west. Charlotte, when they came west, was pregnant with my great-great-grandfather, and he was born just north of Lincoln, Nebraska, on Sanders County on the way west. She was a tough lady and gave birth on the trail. That's where he was born. They came out to Utah. We've been in the church a long time. We've been very blessed with all of that.
Thane was called on a mission to Pennsylvania, where he spent 2 years preaching the gospel, serving others, and learning important life lessons.
I was called to the Pennsylvania mission, which was a fairly new mission. Because the mission was new, they had flooded the mission with missionaries. What that meant was, is that missionaries that were already serving would get a companion. The next week, they would split that companionship up and they would give them new companions. And they got to the point that when my group went out, and there were 21 elders and one sister. But anyway, we left Salt Lake, rode on a train to Chicago, and then they flew us from Chicago to Harrisburg. And we got in later in the evening. They took us to this restaurant I'd never, here I'm a little kid from Idaho, never been to in my life. And they said, yeah, you got to have a Whopper. And I said, what's a Whopper? Oh, you're just going to love it. Order a Whopper. And I'm like, what am I ordering? It was a hamburger. Okay. But I didn't know what a Whopper was. Pretty good hamburgers. Anyway. So then we spent the night in the mission. Well, the next day they were farming everybody out, and they got down to where there were four elders they didn't have companions for. And I mean, people had been out in the mission field a week and they got a new companion. President Baker called in four of us individually, and I was one of them. And they said, here's your companion and here's a car. Go to this town and start preaching. And it was, they ran out of handbooks. So I have a list of 10 things we were supposed to do that one of the assistants to the president wrote on a list, piece of paper for us. And we went to Quakerstown, Pennsylvania, Elder Murray and I, got in a car, drove on the interstate from Harrisburg towards Philadelphia, missed the turnoff, had to pay a toll to go out of the mission into Delaware, I think, turn around and try to explain to the person at the door, hey, we made a mistake. We didn't, I mean, here were two Idaho farm kids that we don't know. We finally found Quakerstown. We had to find a place to stay. Neither one of us knew the discussions. The first discussion we ever gave, Elder Murray and I knocked on a door, and the gentleman said, yeah, I want to learn more. And great. Elder Murray knew the first section of the memorized discussions we had in those days. And he did the first part, and then he turned and looked at me. So I opened up the discussions, and we read the discussions out of the book. We didn't know. It was a miracle that people listened to us, but they did. They did. We had to go by the Spirit because we didn't know anything else. We didn't know. We just had to go and do. And that's what we did. We did. And I was blessed to serve in all parts of the state, from the eastern part to the central part to the western part. I spent some time in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and was there during Groundhog Day. It was difficult. We did a lot of tracting. I can remember in the Pittsburgh area, I was in Canonsburg. I can remember tracting and tracting for days on end, and people would never open their doors. And where, as Elder Lambert said one day in his testimony, "I know we're supposed to be out here planting the seeds, but I really think what we're doing is cutting the trees and pulling the roots." So it was before planting seeds. The zone leaders came and visited us one day and said, you guys are not out tracting. And we said, "Well, we are out tracting." And they said, "Well, you can't be because you're not teaching." And we said, "Well, nobody's letting us in." And so for 2 days, they tracked it with us, two solid days, and not one door. And they never said a word after that to us. But what was remarkable was, like, all of a sudden we started teaching. I don't know. You just got to work and persevere, and eventually the blessings come. I was transferred up to Jamestown, New York. I was transferred up with Elder Criddle, and we moved into an apartment that was formerly had been Sister Missionaries there. So Sister Missionaries were transferred out. We took over their apartment. Got the keys and got in, and in the fridge was this beautiful looking kind of a shepherd's pie with a note on it. "Hey, we made this for you, elders. We hope you enjoy it." And so I was like, "Awesome." And Elder Criddle goes, "We're not going to eat that." And I said, "What do you mean we're not going to eat that?" He said, "The sister missionaries fixed it." But a few days later, went to a member's house, and they had a teenage daughter who liked the sister missionaries a lot. And we noticed during the whole meal, she was just like, "Why aren't you saying anything?" You know, she was like, she wanted to know some information. And we were just like, you know, they're eating, just being nice, grooving out in those words, you know, those times. And finally, she just couldn't handle it anymore. She says, "So how was the casserole?" "Oh, it was delicious." You know, just played it up, you know. She was just like, "Ah, we made that with dog food," you know. She was so excited, you know. Then we told her, "No, we didn't eat it, of course." Anyway, we burst our bubble.
It was on his mission that Thane met the woman who would become his partner, best friend, and wife.
While serving in Harrisburg, Kathy was transferred in and came in, and I met her at the Harrisburg airport. But I was so rude, I wouldn't even talk to her. I didn't shake her hand. I didn't greet her. I didn't say nothing. I was talking to everybody else. I was so rude. And I am surprised that she put up with me. Look, in those days, there were times when Kathy and I would track together. We were allowed to track single elder with a single sister. Now, at the time, I mean, I didn't know she was going to be my future wife, but I can remember tracking with her. And I know off and on, we did communicate with letters. That was not uncommon. And I know it grew from there. When her father passed away, she went home for the funeral. And he told her she could stay home because she only had 6 months or so left on her mission. And she said, "No, I was called for the full time," and she came back. And we grew more close as time went on. Unbeknownst to me, about a month before she went home, she went to President Baker and said, "I really like this elder." And he was like, "Okay, good." I didn't know that. So later, unbeknownst to me, I go see President Baker about a month or so before I'm ready to go home. And I'm like, "Hey, I really like Sister Brickett." And he was, "Oh, good, that's good." You know, I didn't know that she had went to him. And we didn't know that till later. And when I got home, there was a letter waiting for me from Kathy at home. And my mother was like, "What is this about? What did you do on your mission?" I said, "Baptize people." And she was like, "Well, what's this letter doing here?" So I opened up the letter and I just read it to him. I didn't read it ahead of time. I just read it to my mother. And of course, she was like, Kathy was, "Oh, I want to meet you. I want to come see you." So Kathy came out And she got a job with Everton's Genealogical Publishers and as a bookkeeper. Now, before her mission, Kathy worked for the IRS in Covington, Kentucky. She was a key punch operator. And then she saved up her money and then went on a mission. Paid for her mission with that. And afterwards, she went out to Logan. She was in Logan. So I asked my grandpa if I could borrow his car, and he said yes. And so I was going to take my grandpa's car. Before I left, my mother said, "Now look, you go to Logan and you visit with this girl. And if you like her, you bring her home for the weekend." So I did. Now, I need to preface this a little bit. My folks on my mission moved from Bonneville County, and I didn't know they moved. And I called the phone number, and they said the number is no longer that number. It's a Rigby number. And I was like, "What?" Because they didn't tell me that they had moved. And I was like, "My folks moved on me, didn't they? Were they trying to send a message?" And my brother actually my younger brother Scott got to live in a tent all summer long. He loved it. He thought it was so much fun because they were building a house. And so when I got home in November, they had the outside shell there for the upstairs. They were living in the downstairs. So there was like a room that my parents had. There was another room that the girls slept in, another room for the boys. The bathroom had a sheet across the door. It wasn't even a door. There was a sheet at the bottom of the stairs and a sheet at the top of the stairs, and that was the door to the downstairs that they were living in. We think about that now, and we think how austere that is, until my dad told me that once when he was young, they moved into an old granary, and they put cardboard up on the inside of the walls to keep the wind from blowing through the granary. And so did we have it tough? Yeah, but not as tough as other people. So I got home in November. And it was only a few weeks later, I and Kathy kind of drove up towards Bear Lake. And I said, "You know, I think we can make a go of it," which was my way of proposing. She thought we wanted to date. And it finally dawned on both of us. So sometime around Thanksgiving, after Thanksgiving, my family was... A lot of us were there. We all went into Idle Falls to do some Christmas shopping. And then Kathy and I went downtown. And she said, "Where are we going?" I'll tell you. So I took her to Farr's Jewelry in downtown Idle Falls. We walked in. And I said, "How about that ring there?" And tried it on. And I paid for it. And then I said, "I'd like you to marry me. I'm proposing right there in the store. If you want to marry me, keep the ring. If you don't, throw the ring in the trash and nothing will be said anymore about it." She kept the ring. Why? I wouldn't even talk to her. She was an awesome lady. So anyway, so we go back to the mall and we're like, "Okay, we want to keep this down low." So we're kind of walking through the mall, and Kathy and I are acting kind of a little depressed, you know. And Maureen comes up to me and kind of pulls me aside. She's, "What's the problem?" I said, "I asked her to marry me, and I don't think she's going to." So anyway, we go back home, and my mother made, I think it was chili, and of course our homemade dinner rolls were just so awesome. And so anyway, we were eating dinner around at this big table. And Kathy reaches into the deal to get a roll with her left hand. And Maureen is like, "Colleen, Colleen, Colleen, I got to talk to you. And so they went kind of into the room. And they're like, "Shh, shh, shh, shh." You know, of course, we're all sitting there. And then so they come back and they go, "I guess congratulations are in order." Yes. So that's how my family found out that I asked her to marry me, and she agreed. And so we were married on the 12th of January, 1973, which means that I got home in November of 72, and we were married. She got home in Ohio in October of 72, and we were married in January. So as my mother and dad say, once you know, don't put it off, get married and get on with things. And so we did.
Kathy came from a wonderful family in Ohio who also had strong roots in the gospel.
So Kathy and I got married in January. It's part of our honeymoon. We went back to Ohio and had a reception there back in Ohio. All the way back, she kept telling me, now look, the house that we're going to stay in was built in 1866, I believe, right after the Civil War. And there's no running water. We barely have electricity. We're cooking off of propane. She kept telling me, and I kept saying, well, that's no problem. And it wasn't a problem. But it was a real basic house and austere living. And I got to go back there and meet her family. Kathy grew up about 50 miles upriver from Cincinnati in Ohio. Her grandparents, Amos and Rosalia Prickett, around 1903, 1904. One night, Rosalia put a kerosene lamp in the window. That night, some missionaries were lost in the woods, and they saw this lamp in the window. And so they came and knocked on the door. And of course, Amos and Rosalia put them up in the barn, because that's where they put visitors, fed them, were taught the gospel, and joined the church. And that's how Kathy's family joined the church. So a couple of years after Amos and Rosalia were baptized, Kathy's father, Cecil, was baptized. And he was kind of a confirmed bachelor. Cecil, I never met Cecil. I'm looking forward to seeing him on the other side. But he was kind of a bachelor guy. And he would do all kinds of work for all kinds of farmers in the area. One day, he was painting a barn, and he was up on a ladder. And this girl come running around the corner of the barn and knocked him off the ladder. And that's how he met his future wife, Nettie. Before they got married, Nettie had to make a decision. Her family were very strong Methodists. She did not want the children in the family raised part in the LDS church and part in the Methodist church. She made a commitment to join the church and never look back. Now, there's something about my mother-in-law. She was a real stubborn lady, but in a good way. When she set her mind to do something, that's just the way it was. And she never looked back. Love that lady.
As they started their newlywed life, Thane and Kathy were both working. Pretty soon, Thane began his career in the Air Force as a military working dog handler, a position he loved very much.
And Kathy and I started out life in Logan, Utah. She worked for Everton Publishers. I got a job working for Wurlitzer Piano, and that's where I started working. Eventually, I got to learn how to drive a forklift. And for whatever reason, they chose me to work on what's called the finished planer, which is a planer that has to make like the keyboards beds that the keyboards lay on. So I would build parts of piano that had to be within a thousandth of an inch from corner to corner, level and straight and flat. And they taught me how to tune that planer and how to sharpen it. And it was an awesome job. And I enjoyed lots of it, but it became very mundane. So we looked around, and one of the things that we considered was the military. And so we joined the Air Force. Kathy was pregnant at the time. And so when I joined the Air Force, we moved Kathy back to Ohio so she could be with her mother. And while I was in basic training, Lance was born. And then after basic training, I went to security police school. While in security police school, I watched a dog demonstration that they all took us there and we watched it. And then they told us, you know, if you want to become a dog, what they called a dog handler, the official title is military working dog handler. If you want to become one, you can volunteer. And so I said, stick around. And so they took us out and marched us. And then periodically they'd stop and they'd reach in and tap somebody on the shoulder and say, you can go back to your area. You're disqualified. Found out later people were getting disqualified because they didn't have their uniforms buttoned properly or any little thing. They were just because, as dog handlers, I found out later, you have to know how to pay attention to detail. And I became more and more interested, but kind of, you know, just wasn't sure. And I couldn't talk to Kathy, even if, you know, they told us if you're going to be a dog handler, you're going to stay in Texas for another 3 months. But I kept being more and more interested. They got to where these are all the bad things about a dog handler. They were just trying to weed people out. I reflect on it now. At the time, I didn't understand all that. And finally, he was just telling me how bad it was cleaning the kennels and how the dog would be painting their feces all over the kennels for 24 hours. And then, or you're off for 2 days or 3 days, and then you got to go in to clean the kennel. And now that's true. They never lied. It was all true. And finally, I just had had enough of this, how bad he was trying to make it sound. And I looked at him, and I don't cuss very much, but I looked at him and I said, "Sarge, you grew up on a farm. Shit is shit." And he said, "Okay, you can go back to the area." And I was just like, oh, well, that was it. So a few days later, they said, "Okay, we're going to pick a handful of you to become dog handlers." And I had no chance to talk to Kathy. Well, do you make this decision? Not make, you know, it was just, yeah. I had done quite a bit of praying about it, just wasn't sure what to do. And I finally came to the conclusion I was going to have to decide. And then Heavenly Father was either going to bless me or not based on my decision. I mean, I have a lot more wisdom about that process now than I did at the time. But anyway, they called my name, and I sat there for maybe 2 seconds and got up and stood on against the wall. And here's what I found out later. Those people, I got to stay in Texas for 3 more months. 75% of the people that were sitting in that theater that day went to Europe unaccompanied without their families for 18 months. And I wasn't one of those. I got to go to dog handler school instead of Europe for 18 months without my family. It was a blessing. And so I got to stay in Texas and go to dog handler school and go to back to Ohio, bring Kathy to Texas, and we lived in Texas until I graduated. And then we went to our first duty station, which was Fairchild Air Force Base. And so we had to change a station in 73. We had to change a station in 74. In 75, I had orders to go to Thailand. So in 74, I had to go to some training in Texas. So I moved Kathy back to Ohio, went to the training, went back to Fairchild out process. And I had like 7 days left before I was going to get on a plane to fly to Thailand because Vietnam War was winding down. And they canceled my orders. And the orders stated, wherever you are, that's your new base. Well, I was still at Fairchild. So then I had to in process back. I had to write a letter to the base commander and say, "Hey, I had orders. We were living in government housing, but we moved out of government housing, but my orders were canceled. Can I be moved to the top of the waiting list?" And the base commander approved it. So I went to the base housing people. And I said, "Here's my letter." And the lady was very nice. And she goes, "Okay, here's the deal. We're going to offer you some quarters. You can decline those quarters. But then we're going to offer you a second quarters. And if you decline those, you go to the bottom of the list. So you either could take the first choice or the second if you want to live in government quarters." And she said it like 3 or 4 times. I'm like, "Oh, I got it. I got it." So she gave me the address for the quarters. And I took the keys. I went and looked at the quarters. And it was a nice quarters. It was on base. It was nice. And then I went back and she goes, "Okay, what's your decision? Because I can't look at the second quarters till I decline the first quarter." And I'm like, "I decline." She goes, "Okay, here's the second quarters." I was her next door neighbor. And we were actually living in what used to be the former base commander's quarters out by the airport. There had woods for our backyards. It was an awesome place. And I was a dog handler, and I got to come out there periodically and bring my dog and visit with the family when I was on duty, which is probably not supposed to do, I guess. But again, as courtesies, can kind of do what we want when we want sometimes.
During his time as a dog handler, Thane worked with some very special pups.
last year or so I was at Fairchild, I was blessed to have a dog named Pete. Pete was a narcotics detection dog. I was trained to do that and had some great experiences with that. Pete then, he stayed at Fairchild and I went to Korea and I picked up a dog there named Kelly, who was a animal that, dog that liked to bite. He bit the handler before me a lot. When I was chosen to work with Kelly, there was something about me and Kelly the kennel master saw, but he said, look, now normally when you meet your dog, you would go in and you would meet the dog and play, you take him out of the kennel, and for a day you'd play and do go through the obstacle course and get to know the dog, but you'd have like a day. Well, I got a whole week that all I did was sit there and read to Kelly. And the kid, that's what Sergeant Livingston wanted me to do. So that's what I did. And unbeknownst to me, I don't know if it was that week, whatever, Kelly and I got along really well. Now, Kelly did bite me 3 times. 2 of them were my fault. One was not my fault. So, but I got bit 3 times in the time that I had Kelly. And he was an awesome dog. He was the best dog. Now, they were supposed to be trained so that you could send them after an intruder. But if the person stopped, you could say, call the dog off, and they would come back to you. But Kelly, if you sent him out, he was not coming back until somebody got bit. So the kennel master just basically said, he's like a bullet. You send him, he's gone. And he was a great dog to have in Korea. I love that dog.
While Thane was serving in the Air Force, their family began to grow and was sent to many interesting places as his career advanced.
So we, for our first 5 years, we had to move about every year. Lance was born while I was in basic training. And then 11 months later, Jason was born in Spokane at Fairchild Air Force Base Hospital. And so we had 2 kids at the time. And so her and the boys went back to Ohio with all of our goods. And then I went to Korea. While I was in Korea for a year, she was there at home with her mother and with the kiddos, Lance and Jason. And then I came back from Korea and had orders to go to Cheyenne, Wyoming, to F.E. Warren. And at that time, I had made enough promotion, they promoted me out of being a dog, that is the way I say it. After Korea, we went to missile duty, Cheyenne, Wyoming. Missile duty is different in that you go out to a missile site and you're out at a missile site for like 3 days and then you're back home doing training and off for a few days. And missile was okay. And that's where Kathy and I had to make the decision of, were we going to stay in the Air Force or were we not going to stay in the Air Force? We made a list of pros and cons and kind of went through and finally decided to re-enlist. Part of the enlistment was for me to change station again. And then, so we went to Holloman Air Force Base down in Alamogordo, New Mexico. And I went to Tactical Air Command and found out what TDI was really about. Now, TDY is temporary duty. And so they put you on an airplane and you go some other place for a period of time. So I got to go to Egypt. I got to go to Saudi Arabia. When I was leaving Egypt, I had, again, an Egyptian military ID. And I was supposed to turn it in. But I wanted to keep it as a souvenir. So I'm in line to get on the airplane to fly home. And an Egyptian security policeman came up to me and said, ID card, ID card. And I was like, I turned it in. I was lying. And he said, no, ID card, ID card. And I said, I must have lost it. Lying. I was a liar. Anyway, and he goes, okay, calaboose, that's jail. Okay. And it finally dawned on me. It was like, okay, you can go to calaboose or you can get on the plane and go home. Oh, look what I found. It was way down there in the bottom of the bag. And I gave him the ID card. If you've ever seen old World War II TV shows about World War II in the desert, you saw them driving Jeeps through the dunes. We were driving Jeeps through the dunes. We were jumping dunes some cases.
In fact, I had the world's record
and I think it was like 7 or 8 feet. Then these two guys went and jumped 21 feet. But they came down so hard, I just thought, boy, if we keep this up, somebody's going to get hurt. So I, as the NCO, I had to put a stop to it. I said, we have to stop. You guys got the world record. Nobody else is going to, you know, but anyway. Then sometime later, I went TDY to Saudi Arabia. So I arrived in country with a written-in visa, which was acceptable. And there I am, and the person I replaced went home. And then the Saudi government decided they were not going to allow that to occur anymore. And so every passport had to go to the embassy in Washington, D.C. And so that meant that people like me were way down on low on the totem pole. And so I went there in the middle of the summer, I think. I was supposed to be home for Thanksgiving, and I was still there. I was supposed to be home for Christmas. I was still there. I was supposed to be home for New Year's. I was still there. I think I didn't get home till sometime in February. I learned at Holloman how to rappel, and I learned how to rappel out of helicopters at 200 feet off the ground. And I'm still scared of heights, but I was trained to do it and got to do it and got to demonstrate it for other people. It was all kinds of cool stuff like that I got to do. And that's where Lance and Jason were going to elementary school, learned to ride a bike. We lived on Otero Loop, and it was like a big U-shaped, horseshoe-shaped loop. And they could ride their bikes wherever they wanted to on the loop. They couldn't cross the street to the other side. This was on base. When they each turned 10 years old, they got ID cards, and they could go anywhere on base, to the movies, to the commissary, to the, wherever, on base. It was at Holloman that, for whatever reason, instead of doing regular security police work, I was chosen to work on what they call information security. And I got a phone call one day from headquarters, Tactical Air Command, and they said, hey, there's a place up in Mountain Home Air Force Base, Idaho, that needs you to go up there and get them straight. How would you like to go to Mountain Home? And I said, okay. So off we went to Mountain Home. And Mountain Home is where Katie was born. I got there, and the program was pretty messed up, like they said. And I can remember one of the sergeants there had books upon books of memos for record of all the time she talked to everybody about helping them with their security clearances. It was a mess. And I told her to throw them all away, and I'll stand there and tell the auditor. And this sergeant, she was like, really? You can do that? I said, I'm an NCO. I can do that. And so anyway, the inspectors came in, and he's looking through the records and kind of how we were doing our job. And he looked up at me, and he goes, I noticed there's no memos for records here. I said, that's correct. And he goes, why not? And I said, because we called those people. We told them to get here and to do stuff. And if they don't get here, they don't get here. But we called them and we told them. And he goes, well, you don't have a record of that. And I said, sir, I'm an NCO. If I told you that we called them because I'm an NCO. I'm a non-commissioned officer. He looks at me and he goes, all right, I went back to his paper. His sergeant, she was looking at me like, you said that to a lieutenant colonel? I said, I'm an NCO. That's what I am. So then we're sitting in the base theater. Inspection, you know, results are coming in from the different units. They got to our unit, and we got the highest rating you could get. And the lieutenant colonel came up to me later and said, you're an NCO. I like that. I knew a lot of people. I was happy in my job, but it wasn't enough. There was more that I wanted to do. At that moment in time, the Air Force came down and said, we got too many of you security policemen that are E6s. We want to retrain you into these other 10 career fields. Pick one. And so I went to personnel and I said, is there a job more critical that I could be in? And they said, you have to pick one of these 10. They were really pushing everybody into one of these 10 jobs. And I said, well, there's got to be something. Well, if you can find one. And so they put the book of all the Air Force jobs. And it's a big, thick binder. And I got the computer programmer. I said, what about this? Oh, you're not qualified for that. I said, what do you mean I'm not qualified? What do you got to do? You got to take a test. And I finally said, well, can I take the test? So even when I took the test, it was a timed test, 100 questions, multiple choice. Now, I had, in the meantime, I had gone through some schooling. I'd got my undergraduate degree. I was working on my master's degree. And I had taken recently statistics. And part of the statistics course was on tests, how to build a test, take a test. So I knew Air Force was using standardized testing procedures in their multiple choice questions. So, I mean, so anyway, I did pass the test. But I was only there about 18 months. And then I went to Biloxi, Mississippi, to Keesler Air Force Base for computer programming school. It was a 3-month school. And I knew afterwards I was going to be assigned to Gunter Air Force Station in Montgomery, Alabama. So we had 2 cars. I packed one car, packed it with everything we thought we were going to need. And then a few things for me. And I drove it to Mississippi and went to school. In programming school, most Air Force schools are 6-hour blocks and you just go to school. And then you have the rest of the time to do whatever you want. Programming school is 8-hour class and 4 hours of homework almost every night. And if you don't do the homework, you don't pass. It was really a difficult school. And so we went to Gunner Air Force Station. We were there for almost 8 years. Never moved. They were just there forever. And it was great. And we were able to buy a home there. And so the boys went to middle school in Alabama. In the back of the property where we lived was a huge, I wouldn't call it a park, but it was large like a park. And it had a little rise in the back end of it. And at the top of the rise was a school with a playground. And so we were there in Montgomery, Alabama, until we retired. When we retired from the Air Force, our sons were going on missions. We sold the home, and everybody thought that we were barely just going to break even. We sold the home and made a profit that was exactly what it cost for 2 boys for 2 missions. Exactly, almost to the dollar. It was amazing.
Thane has many wonderful memories of the years his kids were young and he and Kathy were raising their family.
So the deal is, Lance was born 11 months after we were married. Jason was born 11 months after Lance. And Katie was born 11 years after Jason. Everything was planned. Maybe. They were just, because they were 11 months apart, and their baby pictures, because they kind of had blonde hair, they kind of looked like almost twins. And so a lot of people thought that they were twins. Their personalities are completely different, though. The interesting story about Lance and Jason, we got us a little Cocker Spaniel dog. We called the dog Pooch. And Kathy heard some strange sounds out in the backyard. And those 2 boys figured they were trying to hang the dog to see what it was like. And so they got in big trouble for that. But the dog survived. One thing that when we were living in Alabama, we had a sister there that met us, and her name was Willie Lou Green. Outstanding elderly lady. She really liked us for some reason. I mean, she made the best custard pie. Now, Kathy, like I said, was a great cook, but she couldn't make custard pie like Willie Lou Green. She made the best custard pie. In Alabama, we became Dutch ovens experts with only one dish. Every Sunday, we would cook a turkey breast, just the breast meat, no bone, turkey breast, in a Dutch oven. And the reason we did was because we didn't want to heat up the kitchen. In New Mexico, we go up to Cloudcroft, I think it was, for father and son's outings. And where I would take the Dutch oven with me and we'd cook up there. And I can remember once we forgot the marshmallows. So the boys roasted Ritz crackers over the fire, and that's what we had. I remember that once, and that we did. We had those kind of vacations in that we did stuff in the local areas. I have fond memories of their Grandma Prickett on summers, either coming someplace where we were and picking up the boys and taking them back to Ohio for the summer. And then at the end of the summer, we would go pick them up and bring them back home for school year. Or we would go at the beginning of the summer, drop them off for the summer, and then she would come and bring them back. So there are times when I think about Kathy and her mother, they would have never had the experiences they did have if we had not joined the Air Force.
Thane loves being a father to his three amazing children, Lance, Jason, and Katie.
Lance has always been in academia, and he loves that world, and that's good for him. Lance served a mission in Guatemala City, and which is where my older sister Marlene served her mission years before. Jason is our more practical son. He does things that drove Kathy and me nuts. For example, Kathy and I kind of always like to have a plan. What's the plan? Do we kind of know kind of what's going on? So Jason went on a mission to Paris, France, and came home from France, and we're living in Idaho at the time. He said, I want to go to Boston. And he was interested in how to repair and bind old books. When we found out how much the school cost, we were just flabbergasted. It was so expensive. But it's what he wanted to do. So he went to Boston, and he worked in Boston. And then one day he calls and said, I'm coming home. I don't want to be living in Boston anymore. So he comes home. He was here a week or so, and off to San Diego he went. But at a single stance, he met his future bride, Tammy. Just for the record, Tammy is our favorite daughter-in-law. We love her a lot. They have adopted two wonderful kids. Katie is a real spontaneous person, and she's had her struggles in life. High school for her was very challenging. She met a guy here in the area. They got married. We have three wonderful grandchildren from that marriage.
Once he retired from the Air Force, Thane and Kathy settled in Boise, where they stayed from then on.
When we first moved to Treasure Valley, we lived in a little apartment on the corner of Ruth and Five Mile in Boise. And eventually, we moved to a home. We bought a home in CUNA, and it was a little home. What we soon came to realize is that we had taught our kids how to grow up, but not how to move away. And so we were just outgrowing the home. We made the decision to leave CUNA, and we came and found a place in Meridian. The story behind this place was the home that we found in Meridian. We were looking for a place, and my mother calls us one day and says, well, why don't you go see your Uncle Daryl? Now, my dad's uncle, Uncle Daryl Curtis, was living in Meridian here. And in fact, from where we live now, he lives about one block away. So we had the home built, and we've been in this place here in Meridian ever since. And Kathy loved it because it was close to everything. We love our neighbors. We have really good neighbors. She loved them dearly and would do all kinds of stuff for them over the holidays, during the year, take them goodies, and just treat them with treats. And that's what she did.
In the last few years of Kathy's life, she was diagnosed with dementia. Both Thane and Kathy clung to their faith while enduring a very difficult period. Thane became her full-time caregiver and continued to be a loyal, adoring husband to his dear wife.
Unbeknownst to us, Kathy had suffered from dementia for a long time. It was a slowly growing disease. We didn't know that at the time for a lot of years. And so life for her was becoming difficult. After, in the midst of the hospital, I believe this is when this occurs, but home health care came. And one of the folks that came was a psychiatric nurse. His name was John. And John would come every couple of weeks, as I recall. And they would sit and visit. He'd check her vitals and stuff. Well, one day they were sitting on the couch. And John looked at her and he says, "You do know something's wrong with your brain." And she said, "Yes." And that's the first time I think she really recognized that there was something wrong and she couldn't control it. So I became her caregiver. It was part-time when she could kind of take care of herself. Kathy got to the point where she was afraid to drive. She was afraid she was going to be in an accident and hurt somebody else. She wasn't worried about herself. She was worried about hurting somebody else. Again, she just cared about others. It got to a point where she didn't want to live anymore. It was just, and I think it's because your brain's not working. You're not thinking as we would think. So all we can do is love them. But I had to be here 24/7 all the time. I had to help her. I was fortunate that I got respite care for 4 hours on Saturday mornings. And that's when I would go do shopping. And I'd run around town like a little rabbit as fast as I could from place to place. I didn't like standing in line because I had all these stores to go to and all this stuff to get. And I was very fortunate that the work allowed me to work from home. And so I was able to work and still help take care of Kathy. And we did that for a number of years. And finally, Kathy had fallen a few times and I was not physically able to get her up. This is my confession part. I had been prompted by Heavenly Father for several months, go find a place for Kathy. I couldn't do it. My job was to take care of Kathy. It was not to go find a place for her to go live. But eventually, the promptings became so profound, I couldn't ignore them. So I started searching for assisted living for Kathy to go to. After visiting numerous places through prayer, I put down a deposit on a place. And then I was so frustrated for a whole week trying to figure out how in the world was I going to tell Kathy what I had done. And it was time for her to go to assisted living. How was I going to do that to my love? To the person that had put up with me from the first day that I wouldn't even talk to her through all those years of being gone in the military and her having to take care of the kids all by herself and being an introvert and struggling with some of those things through her life. And I was going to put her in assisted living. Well, after about a week, I was helping her get dressed one Saturday morning. And I was kneeling down on the floor and I was helping her put on her socks and her shoes. And I looked up into her eyes. She looked down into mine. And she said, "It's time for me to go to assisted living." As time wore on, Kathy became more and more like a little child. She could not tell you what day of the week it was. She didn't know who the president was. There was all kinds of things she didn't know. But she always remembered her grandkids. She always remembered me. She always remembered her friends and neighbors. It was great for me because instead of being a caregiver, I got back to being a husband. And in fact, I treated all those times that I would go see her like a date. So initially, when she physically could, we'd get in a little car and we'd travel around the farm country because she loved farm country. But we'd have dates. And then eventually, physically, she got to where she couldn't leave the facility. I got to go in and date her all the time, which was awesome. She loved McDonald's fish sandwiches. She loved Arby's roast beef sliders without the cheese. And she loved little individual pies of cherry and blueberry with a little container of ice cream. And there were times. So, for example, Relief Society president on Valentine's Day brought me two heart-shaped sugar cookies with icing on it. Very sweet of her to do that. And so when I was going to see Kathy that night, I took them with me. And I sat them down in front of her, and she picked up one, and I said, oh, your water's low. Let me go down to the kitchen and refill your water jug. And so I took off, and I come back, and she's eating on the second cookie. And I looked at her, and I said, you do know that's my cookie. And she looked back at me and said, so? With a glint in her eye. So there were times when, yeah, she was all there. You know, we celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary while she was in assisted living. Kathy loved red cardinals. So we have a picture of her in her red cardinal PJs. And wonderful that we could celebrate 50 years that she put up with me. And that's just the remarkable lady she was. There were a lot of times when I would go and she would lay in bed and she'd start dozing or sleeping. And I would just sit there and listen to her breathe. And but just to be with her, we didn't have to have a conversation. We didn't have to talk about all the troubles of the world and all the good things. And we didn't have to have big spiritual discussions. We just enjoyed being around each other. It was an awesome time that I was able to share those special moments.
On October 11th, 2023, Kathy peacefully passed on to the next life, where Thane knows he will see her again.
She was diagnosed with it's a lung fibrosis of the lungs, to where it's difficult to breathe. So she was on oxygen, and eventually, it just got her weaker and weaker. And then one Sunday afternoon, or I guess it was early Sunday morning, she fell. They finally got her up and got her into bed. And she was just really tired, and she went to sleep. And I was there Sunday afternoon, and I visited with her. But she was just sleeping and just slept. And then Monday she slept. And Tuesday she was still sleeping. I visited her again on Tuesday and Monday. And Wednesday morning, real early in the morning, they called me. They had checked on her at 2 in the morning, and she was just sleeping. And they checked on her at 3, and she had passed away. Kathy always said, I want to die in my own bed while I'm asleep. She got to die in her own hospice bed when she was asleep. That's what happened. I was able to spend some time with her before they took away her physical body. And just had prayers of gratitude, Father. He would have blessed so much with one of his special daughters. Because Kathy was not a run-of-the-mill. She was a special daughter of family. And he blessed my life so much. Her. I miss her greatly.
Family has always been the center of Thane's life, and today that continues with his role as grandpa. Each of his grandchildren holds a special place in his heart, and he's found unique ways to connect with every one of them.
There's Jada, who likes to be called Jay. And then there's Lane, and then there's Olivia. I see them quite a bit. They come over and visit quite a bit. They get to spend the night quite a bit. Last year, Lane, for example, when he turned 12, his birthday present he wanted really bad was he wanted to go to Shields. And on his birthday was their grand opening. But I took Lane to that grand opening because he wanted to go. And he loved it. He thought that was just the coolest thing, that he got to go to Shields on his 12th birthday. Olivia likes going to there now. One of the things that I have with Olivia is that when you go through the doors, sometimes they have these fans blowing down. And I keep telling her I can't get through the doors with all the air blowing through, that I need help. And so I make a big production of trying to get through the door, and I'm not strong enough. She has to take my hand and pull me through the door to get me in, you know. But, you know, she loves that, and I love doing it. That's just a thing that we have with her. Adam and I have this thing where I always carry with me what's called a challenge coin. The thing with a challenge coin is when you meet another service member, you can challenge them. And if they don't have a challenge coin, they owe me a root beer. Well, Adam and I, every time I see him, we have this thing, I challenge him. And so the first time I challenged him, he didn't have a coin. So I gave him my coin. And I said, now listen, every time I show up, I'm going to challenge you with a coin. You better have this coin, you know, or you'll have to buy me a root beer. Well, since then, I've bought him different coins from different places I've went. I've actually done way more traveling since Kathy's passed away than we ever did, Mary. I went to more national parks, which I love, and just go and see them and see the beauty. And so I collect coins at the national parks, and I challenge Adam with those coins. And so that's become a big production now. Sophia, I love buying her jewelry. She loves jewelry. I love buying it. That doesn't mean that my taste and her taste are the same, but lately Jay has just got his learner's permit. And so I've been challenging him to drive my electric car. And he doesn't want an electric car. He wants a Challenger or a Dodge Charger. He wants a muscle car. But I've been challenging him to drive the electric car because he needs to learn how to do it.
Nowadays, Thane is still working as a software architect. He's a major asset to his company and has been with them for 32 years.
I'm a software architect. I work for a company called Nelnet. I help people, mentor them in their jobs to become better software engineers. I work some days in an office and some days, most of the time, I work from home. Kathy, because of her ailments, I became more and more of a caregiver for Kathy. There was a company policy in those days that you could not work from home, but I was working from home. I was breaking the company policy. And the folks, the leadership in Boise, were very gracious to me to allow me to do that. But I just knew in my heart that that could not continue. Well, periodically, leadership from the main headquarters comes to Boise, and they visit with everybody, and they have meetings. And so I went in to talk to the president of the company. I could not let my leadership in Boise get in trouble for letting me work from home when the policy was I couldn't work from home. And the way I remember it was like, why are you even asking the question? He said, the company policy is not for you. We don't worry about you. So work from home as much as you want to. And so I did. I've been with them since November of 1993. So this year it'll be 32 years.
When he isn't busy being grandpa or working, Thane can be found woodworking in his garage. He's made some truly exquisite pieces of furniture and is a very talented craftsman.
When I was a caregiver for Kathy, I needed something to challenge me. And I don't remember the start. And I saw some YouTube videos by a gentleman called Paul Sellers. he was able to build furniture using only hand tools. That really appealed to me because if I have a machine running, I can't hear Kathy if she needed me. I think what happened over time is it became, I could focus my mind on something, but you're in this zone. Some of the furniture that we have in the house, I built. Furniture I bought. I have a really old dresser that I use in the bedroom that I got at an estate sale. Got it by a miracle, and it looked really bad. I brought it home and cleaned it up and waxed it up, and everybody that sees it just loves it. I just love that kind of stuff. I built all kinds of stuff for people. I built Lance a big computer desk. Katie, I built her a farmhouse table for them to have. And I built Kathy a side table, and I built her a sofa table. Lately, I have been, I'll find a piece of furniture at an estate sale, and I'll repair the furniture, and then I'll just donate it.
Thane's life has not always been easy, but he has maintained faith in God and endured his trials with hope in his heart and generosity towards others.
So since Kathy's passed away, I have my own challenges physically. I've had some challenges physically myself. There are times when I go visit her grave. In fact, this last time I went over there, to Yukon. She's buried in the Yukon Cemetery. We have four generations of Curtises buried there. So I was having a woe is me pity party. So I went to the grave of my great-grandfather and grandma, William and Elizabeth, and I said, woe is me. Life is hard. And they were like, you don't know what hard is. Go on. Get out of here and get to work. Okay, you're not going to listen to me. I'm going to go see my grandma and grandpa's grave. So I did. Next, right there, saw Noel and Beatrice, and woe is me. Life is too hard. You don't know what hard is. Now get back to work. Okay, you're not going to. I'm going to go to my mom and dad. They'll listen to me. So I went to my mom and dad's grave, and I said, Mom, Dad, woe is me. Life is really hard. You think you know what hard is? You don't know hard. Get back to work. Okay. So then I said, well, I guess, Kathy, you're going to have to hear it. So woe is me. Life is too hard. And I was reminded by Kathy, and really from my Heavenly Father, but through Kathy, I think, at least I believe, of a little plaque we have on a microwave and have had for many, many years. Come what may and love it. Thank you, sweetheart. So even though I have physical challenges, I've tried to love them. And it's not easy. It's not easy. But us Curtises know how to work. Us Curtises, we're not quitters. And although we don't have to stand in the front row to be recognized, we're there to give support, to help, and a lot of times do things anonymously. Because we don't want recognition. We want to bless the lives of others. I will tell you an incident that I had with Sophia. When Kathy passed away, my company, Nelnet, bought us a super bouquet of flowers. I had to get them from here over to Yukon. And I didn't have room for this big bouquet of flowers. So I decided, so Jason and Tammy came up for the funeral. Brought Sophia and Adam with them. So a day or two before we went over to the funeral, I took Sophia and I said, Sophia, why don't you come with me? We're going to go run an errand. And then I was explaining to her while we went to our destination. I said, now, I want you to remember something about your grandma. She loved to give anonymously and she loved to help people. So we're going to go give anonymously. Well, where are we going, Grandpa? I said, you'll see. So she was holding on in the floor of the car and flowers all over the place, a big bouquet. We went to the hospital. We went up to the nurse's station on one of the floors and we gave them the flowers. And we said, we know there's someone on this floor that needs these flowers. We didn't tell them what they were for. It wasn't important. They didn't need to know that. And then we left them and we walked away. We don't know what happened to the flower. Heavenly Father does. He blessed somebody's life. But it was important that Kathy and I could help Sophia understand the importance of giving and giving anonymously.
Thane is a humble servant and follower of Christ. He has a beautiful testimony of the love of God and his Savior.
As we yearn for Christ in our lives, it is important for us to remember to forgive one another. Dr. Dieter F. Uchtdorf said, and I quote, we must recognize that we are all imperfect, that we are beggars before God. Because we all depend on the mercy of God, how can we deny to others any measure of the grace we so desperately desire for ourselves? My beloved brothers and sisters, should we not forgive as we wish to be forgiven? End quote. I've learned over time it's important to forgive each other. We are all so imperfect. It's because of Christ, though, that if we press forward with a steadfastness in Christ, if we have a perfect brightness of hope and a love of God and of all men, then our Heavenly Father, he will say to us, you shall have eternal life. I struggle to understand why Heavenly Father gave Kathy dementia and allowed that to occur. But I have great faith that the day will come when Kathy and I will kneel before Christ and Heavenly Father with gratitude in our hearts for those experiences. As long as I strive and I work, Christ will make it all. It will happen. And Kathy and I will get to be together forever. And we'll get to be with our loved ones forever. And then truly, my great-grandpa Curtis can back me up, bop me up the back of the head and tell me, hey, no woe is me. Let's get back to work. Because that's what us Curtises do. We don't quit. We go to work. I miss Kathy a lot. But I know I will get to see her again.
As you've heard, Thane Curtis is a giving, kind, gentle soul who has experienced hardships, big moves, wonderful family relationships, and has served others freely throughout it all. His story is one of quiet strength, deep faith, and focus on Christ and his beloved family. A huge thank you to Thane Curtis for making this episode possible and for being interviewed. If there is someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, Email us at hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website, hearingourheritage.com.